You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Jeremy Davis. Jeremy.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
Jeremy's joining us today. And over here on my left, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello there, Mike.
Now you know why Jeremy's joining us today.
Because that's it. That's all we got.
And joining us is our good friend who's been on the podcast more than anybody else.
Ooh.
Greg Ondo from Steinberg.
All right, Greg.
Ooh. Guys, this is show 116.
Wow.
And yeah, this is what we're down to.
They said it wouldn't last.
And it looks like it might not. No, actually, we have a lot to talk about, but yeah, welcome to show 116. The Audio Nowcast is a podcast where we get industry professionals talking about the audio industry. And I want to mention that because it seems like we're getting a lot of new listeners. Of course, we're probably going to lose a lot of listeners after this podcast. But I just want to welcome everybody who's listening to us either for the first or second time. But hey, Dave's show, wasn't that awesome? Last 115?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Got a lot of really good compliments on that show, and Dave was awesome. So, and he also said, you know, anytime we wanted him by, we can just, you know, call him up, and if he's available, he'll come and stop by. So that's cool.
Cool. And he talked about us on his show, right?
Yeah, I should have called him today. No, but we're a little thin because there's a lot of people out there that are working. I know Andrew. First of all, I want to congratulate Andrew Sheps on his Grammy. Mm-hmm. It was great to see him up on stage. Did he remind you of the Oak Ridge Boys? That's
totally like maybe a little bit. Maybe a little bit.
He had a really great shot. I mean, it was like, there he is.
There's Andrew.
There's Andrew. So, no, that's great. And I talked to him, and he's leaving for London, so he couldn't make it with us today. But when he gets back, we'll talk to him. I never found out if he found the red carpet, but we'll find out.
He must have found an entrance. We know he made it to the stage.
But that was really cool. Did you watch the Grammys, either one of you?
I did.
Did you watch it, Jeremy?
I actually DVR'd it because I was working. Uh-huh. So, but I did catch the end, and I actually caught the beginning, too. Those were pretty much all I needed to see, according to everyone that saw it.
Yeah, so. That's true. I will say that Bruno Mars, that guy killed it. That was, you know, it just goes to show you, it doesn't matter what type of music, but if you do it well and your band is tight, and it was just, you know, that whole James Brown thing that he did was just phenomenal, you know, and you could tell his band was just on it. If you're playing a live band or you've been involved with music, you know, some nights, even though you're performing, you're not necessarily on the ball, but man, you could tell the band was killing it. You know, it kind of reminded me when Stevie's band back in the day, you know, we'd do some concerts. They were always really good, but some nights they were just on a whole nother level.
Yep. Yeah, and it was all downhill after that to me. There were a few high points, but
like Andrew.
A lot of forgettable stuff. Oh, it's cool seeing Andrew.
Yeah, it was cool seeing Andrew. And it was I'll tell you, the staging was amazing.
Uh-huh.
Just to see, just staging technology in general, that's one of the things I really like at the NAMM show is to go see what's happening with like the lights and the DJ stuff. And I'll tell you, leaps and bounds, you know, the staging and rigging and screens and lighting technology is just, you know, leaps and bounds are improving themselves. And one of the coolest things I saw was LED screens that are about the size of a 50-inch screen that are on a movable base. So the light, it moves like a light, but it's an LED screen. So it's like a TV screen. And so you can move them down, left, right. I mean, it's just, there's just some phenomenal stuff out there. But anyhow, it was, all in all, it was really, really cool to see Andrew. And I was really glad that he got it. And hopefully when he comes back, he'll show us his Grammy.
Like that would be nice. It would be nice. Did he ever show us his last one? Maybe not.
No. But moving on, also, we have to mention that, you know, Whitney Houston passing away on Saturday.
And I hadn't heard that. No, I'm kidding. That's all anybody's been talking about.
Well, you know, the one reason why I wanted to just talk just a little bit is because back in the day when I used to work with Teddy Riley, we were over at Future Recording Studios, and I was working with Teddy setting up a room there, and Bobby and Whitney showed up. And I guess it was just when they started first started dating, and it was just she was so sweet and she was so nice and just you know just had this innocence about her, and it just was really really sad to see what happened. Not just with her passing, but just as she, you know, she got involved with drugs and just kind of went off the deep end. It was, you know, it's just amazing to see the transformation of people, mm-hmm. you know, when they get involved with that kind of stuff. So I'm not trying to lecture or anything, but, you know, it never ends good.
You don't
see too many happy endings if you start down that road. So if you're thinking about it or started, stop and, you know, choose a different path. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, I worked with her back in those days as well on the I'm Your Baby Tonight album.
Look it up.
I'm on there. Yes, I am.
What'd you do?
Keyboard programming and playing and...
Wasn't she just the sweetest thing? I mean, she was really sweet.
Actually, I got to work with her at times when things were going well. And she was very sweet, and I got to work with her at times when things were not going as well. And the sweetness varies accordingly. But the main thing was she was incredibly talented. I mean, her voice back then, I remember sitting there while she was doing her vocal and just, you know, couldn't believe what you were hearing.
Yeah. She definitely had an amazing, amazing voice. Anyhow, that was kind of a bummer when I found out about that. So enough said. Anyway, on that note, I have no idea how we're going to segue to lighter things. But Greg, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be back.
And Greg is from Steinberg. And why don't you you haven't been with us for about, what, a year, almost 2 years?
Yeah, maybe about a year and a half or so.
Just tell us a little bit about what you do over at Steinberg. And
My title is Field Marketing Manager. So I kind of go around throughout the country and I do a lot of trainings for dealers. I do a lot of YouTube videos. Like if you go to the Steinberg Software YouTube channel, I've done a lot of videos there. Or if you also go to Club Cubase. And we do a lot of user groups. We average about 21, 22 user groups in different cities throughout the country every month. And it's just kind of, you know, people getting together and we go over maybe new features or how to use this feature. So I do a lot of that and set up the user groups.
And I've been to some of the LA user group meetings. They're really, really great. It's a great way to have Greg as a captive question answerer.
Yeah, and a lot of times what we do is we just will, you know, actually I'll open up a text document and people go, I don't understand this. I want to do this better. And we'll just write it down and we'll just go through and answer everyone's questions.
And how's things going over at Steinberg right now?
It's been great. Yeah, we just came out with a whole slew of new hardware products out in the fall. So we have some USB 2.0 audio interfaces that have integrated DSP, kind of like our MR816 with the FireWire interfaces, and as well as a CMC series of modular controllers that have been doing great.
That's great. Well, you'll have to tell us a little bit more about that in a little bit. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, what's the difference between Cubase and Nuendo?
Have you ever been asked that before?
Never been asked. A lot of times, Cubase is obviously great for music production. Nuendo is geared more at post-production. So if you need to do more, you know, deal with pull up and pull down, right. If you need to have network collaboration, you could do that. So my one sentence answer would be, you know, if you're making the music for a film, Cubase would do it. If you're mixing the film with all the Foley,
right,
dialogue, sound effects, all that type of, you know, and you need like Euphonics hardware integration, Nuendo is probably the tool for that. They do share the same audio engine, similar code base. So it's very, you know, they look very similar. But, you know, if you're doing post-production, you can probably see the differences pretty immediately.
And actually, quick question from myself too. What's the fastest way to get, if you have, you know, a composer working in Cubase and you're working in Nuendo, what's the best way to get their stuff into Nuendo? Is there a transfer between?
All you have to do, you just simply open the project. So the .cpr, which is the Cubase project file, or the .mpr, the Nuendo project file, are completely interchangeable.
Great. Yeah, I do that all the time. They're the same thing.
Cool.
So any plan from Steinberg to ever put them into one, to combine them into one product?
One product.
Yeah.
Well, that's called Nuendo, right? I mean,
if you have Nuendo with the NEK, and the NEK is the Nuendo expansion kit, and that gives you all the MIDI functionality of Cubase. So if you had to do with the NEK, you kind of have the mothership program. But you know, we would see a lot of post people are like, oh, I don't want to deal with MIDI. That's kind of that other guy,
right,
who sits in the corner, does MIDI stuff. And there's some people who are like, okay, I do programming, I do MIDI, I do post, I do probably people like Rob who will take advantage of all that. But there's a lot of, you know, and you probably know from working in post environment, right, you know, they kind of shun MIDI in a lot of ways. So we kind of have that delineation.
You know what? I will never shun MIDI. MIDI always has a place with me.
Oh, that's good.
Hey, let me give you a chance right now to sell me, you know, Nuendo. Why is it so awesome? Tell me a little bit about it.
It's kind of designed from the ground up as a native solution. So whereas we see a lot of the functionality that's kind of been implemented recently in other products, you know, that's stuff that we've been doing for 10 years.
Right.
You know, like the clip-based automation, having your fades in real time. So, you know, we've been doing a lot of, you know, the workflow is going to be significantly faster. Plus, you know, we're optimized for all the multi-core processors. You know, everything we do is 64-bit. So if you have more than 4 gigs of RAM, you could use it. We think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, we have support for your product when you're using third-party hardware or when you're using our hardware.
I'll tell you one thing, and I've used Nuendo and I've used Cubase. I mean, even though I'm a Pro Tools guy, the one thing that Nuendo and Cubase absolutely just kills Pro Tools is organization of assets, you know.
Because
The organization of assets is horrible on Pro Tools. And tell us a little bit about that and how you can organize your assets and move your files around.
Yeah, I mean, we have a media bay, which will allow you to see every file that's kind of relevant to your production needs. So it's not going to look for pictures or your tax returns that happen to be on your hard drive somewhere. It's going to look for kind of video files, audio files, and you can easily tag all of your information. So if you know that you use the sound effect with this client before and you don't want to repeat that, you could actually tag that sound effect for this project with this client so that you don't repeat that. And it searches immediately across your network, all of your local drives. And it's very easy to, you know, search, you know, you type in gun and it'll find every sound effect that has the word gun in it.
Right.
And you could do all of your different metadata all handled right there. And it's kind of like, you know, like a media database that's built right in. It's not an additional purchase. It's just part of the program. And it will automatically kind of scan all of your files, and you could choose specific folders for not to look into. So that way it kind of works as you would expect.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, asset management is so important, especially when you're working in post-production. Well, actually,
because you don't have enough sound files.
Sometimes you want a certain, you know, if you could organize your files and like, okay, this is, I'm going to be doing something a little more spacey, so I need space sound design. And this one's going to be a little bit more organic, so I need a lot of natural sound design. And sure, you can organize your sound effects that way, but it's much easier. You have your sound effects on your drives and you just pull them and you have a basic little template of all your nice little assets there that you use every single time. I just think, you know, it just seems so obvious, but you know, there's DAWs out there that just don't quite get it, you know, and they're not there yet.
Well, and it's not just about organizing the assets, like the fact that Pro Tools doesn't have folders.
Yeah.
You know, folder tracks and folders in the bin. I mean, you could have a million sounds in the bin and there's just no way to organize them.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing at this point.
I know. I wonder why.
I've told my friends that have that too. It's crazy. And Nuendo's organization is amazing, or Cubase. I use folder tracks for MIDI all the time. Like if you're grouping, like maybe all your orchestral stuff or all your rhythm stuff, you know, it's just so easy to be able to organize tracks into folders, and then you can mute folders and edit whole folders. It's just, the organization's amazing, and it's so good that it kind of, and it seems so logical. It makes you think every system would have organization like this, and then it's kind of shocking to find out.
It seems obvious.
It seems obvious because it's such a good implementation and it feels so natural. But the idea that, you know, well, we've talked about it before, the fact that you can't put your sounds in a folder. So in Pro Tools, you might have 1,000 gunshots for a scene, and they all have different names, and you're looking at the thing alphabetically.
Hey, but they put dashes at the end. Yeah.
It's just absolutely just so unacceptable. It's amazing that people put up with it, actually.
No, I know. I know. And I'm one of them that puts up with it. But
I do, too, when I have to. Absolutely.
But you still do a lot of writing on Nuendo, don't you?
And yeah, actually now I usually use Cubase. I basically go back and forth between whichever one has the cooler features because they kind of leapfrog each other. So like Nuendo will be the coolest for a while, then Cubase will be the coolest.
It's great for upgrades for us.
Yeah, Rob gets you going through the dark years.
But I tend to leapfrog back and forth, but now I do everything in Cubase, all the MIDI. And I try all the other sequencers too, but there's nothing as intuitive for me as Cubase.
Well, obviously, you know, you got Cubase and Nuendo. And, you know, I do want to tell people too that you don't necessarily always have to have one tool that you work with. You know, if you're curious about trying a Cubase and let's say you're a Pro Tools or a Logic guy, there's no rule that says you can't have more than one DAW out there and use them for different things because I do. I use them all, really.
I do too.
They all excel at different things.
And I generally run them on different computers because I don't like to bog any one machine down too much. But what I do now is I use MIDI over LAN and I use it to send MIDI timecode from Pro Tools to Cubase or vice versa or to Performer or whatever. Right. You know, sometimes I have clients who bring in files for other sequencers and I have to accommodate them. But I use MIDI over LAN now instead of a bunch of expensive MIDI interfaces. It works really great. You just send MIDI timecode.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, like I said, if you're curious, that's, you know, you don't have to justify just sticking with one. You can use as many tools as you need to get the job done. One thing I wanted to talk about, Steinberg, is what about, you know, software instruments? Do you have what's happening over there on that front?
Recently, we just released Howlion 4, which is kind of our sampler. And we've kind of used that code base for a lot of different instruments. The first instrument that kind of used Howlion 4 engine was the Grand 3.
Right.
And then we came out about a year later with Howlion Sonic, which is kind of, you know, what a lot of people used Hypersonic for.
Right.
And what's great about the Howlion Sonic is it's using a lot of the same sound design team that is the Yamaha motif, because since we're in the Yamaha family. So it's not just kind of a typical batteries included sound set.
Right.
So it's a very professional sound set. And then, you know, releasing kind of the flagship instrument of Howlion 4 easily allows you to do all the sound design work, plus having capabilities for note expression so that you could have like pitch bend on one note within a chord independently of the other notes. And as you make your own samples, you can automatically have the VST expression maps automatically created as well. So we've been very busy with that, and we also have different sound sets that we're selling at steinberg.net that you could get like additional add-on modules for that.
Did you guys get out of the soft synth game? I mean, do you have any of the because there was a time where you had some really, you know, cool like X-Phrase and Plex and some of those, and any plans to get back?
We're still doing some of that. We just announced on our Facebook page on Friday an instrument called Pad Chop, which is going to be kind of a lot of people are already kind of likening it to X-Phrase. You know, we worked previously, you know, we partnered up with a company called Wizzu for a lot of those instruments, and they were acquired by another company.
We won't say.
Yeah. And, and we kind of seen a lot of development kind of basically stop on those, and we don't have access to all the content.
Right.
But some of the things that we have done for some of our instruments, like Model E, which is one of the very first Mini Moog models, is we've actually, you know, free of charge, just updated them for the latest operating systems and released them free. So we've seen some instruments like that, like our VB1, our bass, the Model E, and some of the other instruments, and as well as for our MIDX drivers. So for our older 8x8 audio interface or MIDI interfaces that have been discontinued for 8 or 9 years, they actually just, you know, released new drivers for Lion and Windows 7 64-bit.
Yeah, that was a very exciting day for me when I found out about that, because I have 8 of those interfaces.
Right.
And, you know, I was just thinking they're dead in the water. I'm never going to be able to use them again. And I'm glad I didn't give them away or throw them away, because then they came out with Lion and Windows 7 drivers. Kind of out of nowhere. There was no announcement. Yeah. It was just, check out what we did.
That was very nice of you, Greg. I just want to say thank you.
I have two of the interfaces myself. So sure. I was like, yes, I can upgrade my computer.
Oh, they're great interfaces. They're really, really good.
Wait, are you sure there wasn't any influence, that, you know, that you maybe said, hey, guys, I got these interfaces here. And
I think someone said that.
Yeah.
Well, and it's you know, it's almost like they'll go, okay, you know, they have like their development schedules. And if some guy has a little extra time, they'll go, okay, you know, maybe I think we could do something with this and we could make this work again. So that's what they were kind of doing and just kind of releasing them, you know. So I think they've done six instruments that they've released free.
So what happens? Let me ask you, what happens with the legacy software? Like, because is it just a matter of you just don't even want to support it on the next, you know, operating system? Because there's like some great, like I said, X-Phrase. It's an awesome little synth. I mean, it was doing stuff back in the day that, you know, the just with the motion and the sequencing and all that stuff that, you know, people are, you know, touting, you know, as features, and it was doing it, you know, 10 years ago. And I was just wondering, what happens to this legacy software? Is it just going to...
I think it's actually still being developed. You know, it's done, I think ReFX is the company that kind of originally did it. I think they're still continuing development on it. And Plex, I think, is also... kind of the original developers kind of released that.
I got
as
you.
Well,
so these were developers that were working with Steinberg. They weren't necessarily in house, and so Steinberg, you know, has it for a certain amount of time, but then the developer goes back and may reintroduce it as another product or keep.
Yeah, and
going
sometimes on. You know, with licensing, with the contracts with Wizzu, and then we don't have a relationship because Wizzu doesn't exist anymore.
Right,
we can't really renegotiate a contract with anyone.
Because there was – what was – you had another one, a percussion one that was really cool. Where you
Attack.
Could, was that what it was?
Kind of like a percussion, synth percussion.
Yeah, where you could combine different attacks and different parts of sounds.
Oh, no, that was
– it's a Waldorf.
That was the Wolfgang Palm thing. What was – where you could use the attack of one sound and the ring.
Plex,
Was that – that was Plex?
Yeah. Plex is where you could take kind of like, you know, the attack of one instrument and kind of the, you know.
Okay.
Decay of
but I thought they had. Did they have something like that for percussion? That you had
there,
a percussion.
There's one synth called Attack, which is kind of like a percussion synth.
The Waldorf.
Thing. Yeah, Waldorf thing. And I think
that was
Waldorf,
really good.
I think Waldorf still has that available.
Yeah, they brought it back out. It had died, and then they resurrected
and PVG it. Wave and some of those stuff have, you know, all kind of seen the light of day still.
Wow. So let me ask you another question.
Let me just say one other thing. Keep in mind also that Steinberg created the VST platform in the first place.
Right.
And that there's another reason I use it exclusively to host my virtual instruments. It's just much less buggy than all the other hosts
right.
I have.
Right.
So like if you have to run Native Instruments stuff or a lot of, you know, VSTs that different companies make, there's no host that's going to be more compatible than the Steinberg ones.
And it's also compatible with all the later versions and all the later features of like VST3.
VST3.
Yeah. 3 and whereas some of the other ones are stop at 2.0.
Yeah.
But as Steinberg, what are some of your challenges that you're facing nowadays when you see how the market's kind of developing, you know, with all the big DAWs that do it all and the big, you know, loop-based sequencers and that? I mean, do you guys – are you just going to stay doing your thing? Are you ever look at all that? Or
I mean, we have programs like – you know, we have an entry-level program called Sequel, which is very kind of drag-and-drop friendly, instant kind of musical results. But, you know, we pioneered a lot of these concepts that other people are kind of now claiming that, you know, this is what they're all about. And it's, you know, even – you know, it's always interesting, you know, whenever we see the new features of a program – we see the marketing material. It's like, oh, how do we not know that they couldn't do that before? You know, it's like we've been doing it for 10 years, 12 years. You know, right. It's like that's a feature now. It's like, oh man, I could use that in presentations.
Sampling rates up to 48K.
Yeah. Dare to dream. Yeah.
Well, you know, you guys have been doing it for a long time, and actually, I learned a lot from using Cubase, especially with plugins. That was – I kind of cut my teeth with Cubase and plugins and VSTs and automation and all that. And one thing that I do notice now is not only is it, you know, a smoother experience to work on DAWs in general, but also it just sounds so stinking good, especially Nuendo. Nuendo is still – one of the best sounding DAWs out there by far.
Yeah, I remember kind of doing a shootout at Frank Philpetti's studio, and he was showing it to our Nuendo kind of project managers. And, you know, and he was kind of dumbfounded when they're going back and forth, and it was a pretty obvious difference. And, you know, and like, you know, and I was kind of talking to him about it. They're like, yeah, we didn't understand because we don't do anything to to really make the software sound better, but we work really hard not to screw it up.
Right.
You know, so like they're very kind of very conscious of phasing throughout right. the entire engine. You know, it was like it was very important to have total plug-in delay compensation, be the first company to do that.
Yep.
So, you know, they're very conscious not to mess it up. And I think that kind of is a better way of, you know, kind of starting off your software instead of trying to fix it later. It's probably a lot more software development.
Yeah, because it really does. Nuendo, Cubase, they've always sounded really awesome. If you don't have more than one DAW and you start working with other DAWs, then you'll know what I'm talking about as far as the sound of DAWs, because each DAW definitely can have a sound, and some are way worse than others, you know. Really, 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 I mean, it's pretty significant. So
even just playing like a two-track file, yeah, it's pretty apparent.
It's really apparent, especially I know one that's really popular that just doesn't sound that great when you compare them to what else is out there. But anyhow, well, Greg, it's great to have you here, and sounds like some really cool things are happening over at Steinberg. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, is getting back to those little controllers. Tell us a little bit about that, because I saw that at the NAMM show, and they looked really interesting. You have a slider, and you have a transport. What else do you have?
Yeah, so there's six different controllers. We did, like, all sorts of market research, and it was really interesting. We found that absolutely no one felt the same way about controllers. You know, and it's like some, you know, some people go, okay, I have a MIDI keyboard, so this needs to fit on my MIDI keyboard. Or I have a console, I don't have a MIDI keyboard. Or I'm left-handed, I'm right-handed. So we came out with just a series of little USB controllers. So there's six of them that are modular, and they're probably smaller than a paperback book. They will actually tilt up. One will be an AI knob. So you kind of hover over any plug-in parameter and move the knob, and it automatically controls it, no mapping or assigning. You'll have a transport. You'll have drum pads. And what's kind of cool about drum pads is you can actually – a lot of times when you actually program drum pads – after the drum beat is there, you don't use it for anything, but you could actually put it into bank 16, and you have 16 user definable keyboard shortcuts. So instead of it's like having extra hotkeys, so if you want to quantize, save, new project, whatever. You also have a transport control, a channel control, as well as like a fader, a bank of four faders, and these are touch capacitance faders. So it's kind of like actually just touching a screen. And you can see the fader position, but they'll also have metering built in as well. So there's a series of these six modular controllers, and also one that has like eight knobs called a QC controller.
I gotcha.
That can output MIDI, control like the Cubase EQ and quick controls.
Right.
So you can kind of place them however you want, and they come with like a little clip that you can attach multiple units together. And they're really ideal for travel, because I travel, I fly over 100,000 miles a year. So wow. For me to, you know, be able to take like a really high-end audio interface, two laptops, six controllers, right. and every cable needed, and throw it into a backpack that could fit into a really small, you know, like, you know, 50-seat jet
right.
is a pretty good thing.
Yeah. So. Well, and are they controlled by software, or are they each individually? I mean, is it plug and play? I mean, how
– you install one software, and that would be the extension, and that would be the software for all six controllers.
I
and
gotcha.
Then you know, and at that point, once you install that, as you add other controllers, it's just simply plug and play.
I'll tell you what, they look cool. They're really good looking, nice colored, you know, colored LEDs and stuff. And I would imagine it also would be good for like VJing too, if you not mm-hmm. only just music, if you were into the visuals and things like
yeah.
that, you know, using some of the software that's out there.
Let me just ask one question. Are they USB 1 or 2?
They're USB 1, but okay. they work on USB 2 because they don't really need the bandwidth
need
of USB
speed.
2.
Well, that's actually good because it's easier to extend USB yeah. 1 to a machine room.
Yeah, I was just talking to a producer in New York, and he has, you know, like a 60-foot USB extension, uh-huh. and he just got a powered hub and ran all six of them. No cool. problems.
So. Huh. Well, the cool thing, too, is the size that they are. You could really get some really cool custom little setups for, you know, your desk that you're mixing at, because you can have a little bank over here of sliders and have a little pad over here and have your little transport, you know.
Yeah, because the last thing you want to do when you buy controllers is have to buy new furniture for it. That often costs more than a controller. And it's like, oh, bummer. You know?
Well, especially USB 1.0 controllers. Let's face it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's great. That's pretty awesome. And I saw them over at NAMM, and they looked really good. Are they released yet, or are they?
Yeah, they've been shipping for a couple months. And there's actually kind of different promotions going on, where if you buy two, I think you get $10 off. Buy three, you get $20 or $30 off. Buy four, $40, like a mail-in rebate, or a frame, where you could actually put them with a frame as well.
And what do they run?
Most of them will run, I've seen them on the street for about $149 for all five of them, except for the four faders. I've seen that for around like $199. So
really,
really, really cheap and inexpensive. So
holy smokes!
Yeah. So it's kind of and they're very easy to sneak past a spouse. So you get like one a payday. You
know? That's pretty awesome. But anybody else have anything you want to say about that? Or
yeah. Actually, I worked with Nuendo for the first time probably about 3 months ago in a specific capacity, which was I was doing a voiceover gig, which is something I managed to pick up a lot. And they had Nuendo and the little Euphonics board. And man, the ADR stuff that y'all have in Nuendo is actually really killer. Like a lot of the comp stuff and how the organization when you're actually trying to run through everything really fast is pretty amazing compared to some of the stuff that I've sort of gotten used to. So
yeah, they're always very concerned about workflow. You know, it's a lot of companies can add features, right, but if the workflow kind of inhibits your creative process, it doesn't really do you any good. So workflow is always really essential.
Was it as far as just the organization of the takes, or is it how to comp them together? What did you find?
Yeah, well, the first thing that really happens is that it's organized really well. So let's say you have to go through a bunch of different stuff, and the director in this case was giving notes. You could see sort of how everything was progressing, and it was just all available to you. And then he, of course, as he always does, can I hear these three things from these 17 takes?
Right.
And you go, oh, crap. And I had a chance before the actual session to sort of go through and learn some of the quick tools. And it took me maybe 10 minutes, and it took me 30 seconds each time he wanted anything. And it was just all incredibly fast. The tools were just were pretty much all there, especially whenever I sort of figured out how to set up the two recording tracks that I was working with, because I was working with two mics.
Right.
So I needed to be able to flip between them. And it was great, man. The one thing that actually was sort of hard is with the Euphonics. I didn't have a talkback on that little piece of gear. So you were just mentioning the CMC controllers. Is there a way that I can use like maybe the four fader one and then another one? Is there a talkback function? Because
we have a talkback function in a control room, and you can have, I think if you have like one of each of the controllers, you could have 44 user assignable functions. And if, within Cubase, someone actually counted it up for me. It was like 1,233 keyboard assignable functions. So you could definitely do control room and talk back.
You could assign every one of those to talk back. You could have thousands of talk back buttons.
You could have a drum pad that does it 16 times.
That's definitely something I'm going to have to check out, especially with the four faders. Because, you know, very rarely do you need more than four faders, especially running just an ADR session with.
And you could also run up to four of those units, four of the fader units together. So, in, you know, being very compact with the metering to have 16 channels of faders for, you know, probably under $800.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Wait, but you brought a good point. It's like, you know, just because a DAW can do something doesn't necessarily mean it does it the best or the right way of the workflow. I mean, you know, most of them you can, you know, pick your take from the playlist. But then what Jeremy was saying is if you're working with a director and you want to change that and do, okay, give me take four, take three, and take, you know, seven. It's like, man, you know, you got to be really organized, and you got to, you know, even if you're going a little playlist and going back forth here, it's just to be able to see it, to be able to visually see that. That in and of itself is, like I said, sometimes you want to change different tools for different things, and some of them really excel at other things. And it sounds like ADR is a good place to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Great. All right. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. It was great to visit with you. And then when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk a little tech and maybe tell a couple stories. So we'll catch you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were visiting with Greg Ondo and listening to everything that was happening over at Steinberg. I wanted to talk a little bit about something that is a concept that you hear about that not a lot of people understand. And I don't even know if it's necessarily necessary. And that is headroom.
Ah.
The term headroom. Rob, do you want to define what headroom is?
I get to be the Bobby Summerfield character?
Yes, you do.
Hold on. I have that name tag. Hold on.
Playing Bobby Summerfield, Rob Arbitier.
Yes. Let me see. Well, headroom basically in layman's terms, and thank you for giving me time to prepare an answer, Mike. That's very nice of you.
It was on the email.
Was it? I need to have my emails read to me, apparently.
That's what Siri is for. Don't you have Siri?
I do not have Siri. We can talk for the next half hour about how I don't have Siri, and then I don't have to answer the question. No, headroom is basically the amount of dynamic range that you're not yet using in an audio signal. So a lot of people will say, you know, they'll have their console aligned to have 20 dB of headroom. That means when the console's meters are registering zero, you actually have 20 dB until things clip. So it's sort of the room above what your labeled 0 dB mark is.
So, like, what is the headroom, Greg, for, like, Nuendo? Do you know what the measured headroom is?
I think with the 32-bit floating point, I think you could get up to 1,592 dB.
Wow.
Which is a theoretical.
Okay, so let's say you have all this headroom, but does it matter? Because, I mean, well, zero is zero.
In the digital world, well, actually, in floating point, zero isn't necessarily zero.
Right.
No, that's, be above that's zero. True. But and there have been plenty of articles about that, and we've talked about that in the past. But basically, in digital, you set what you're going to consider as your zero. You know, commonly in music production, it's minus 18. For film and television, it's minus 20. And that means you're giving yourself 18 or 20 dB of headroom above what your labeled zero is before things start to clip. And like for movie theaters, if you pink out your room so that pink noise RMS is at minus 20 dB on your meters, and that's 85 dB measured in the room per speaker,
right?
That means you have 20 dB of headroom above that 85 mark, meaning you could theoretically have things as hot as 105 dB, which is pretty loud. But so headroom is just basically the room you have to play with to make your signal louder until it clips. And that's why in the digital, actually in all space, you have to make sure your headroom is calibrated properly.
Right.
You know, like Andrew mixes on vintage Neve consoles that have very high headroom. It's very hard to get those things to clip and not sound good doing it.
Right.
That's part of the reason they're so cool, is because even if you do overdrive them, they just make everything sound better to a point. But so usually in my studio, I have two sets of calibrations for my D to A's and A to D's, minus 20 and minus 18. And it's usually minus 18 for pure music and minus 20 for everything else with picture.
But does it matter nowadays with the fact that everything is going to get compressed anyhow?
Yes, it does. Because if you're in a 24-bit integer recording,
right,
which is what a lot of people are using. I mean, Cubase has been 32-bit and Nuendo for a long time. But if you're using some of these other workstations that only do integer recording, 24-bit or, God forbid, 16-bit the way it used to be, the softer your signal, the more granular things are going to sound because you're losing resolution. With floating point, you have the full resolution no matter what your levels are.
Right.
But if you work too soft in 24-bit, you'll hear grittiness on your sound. And an easy way to hear this this granularity I'm talking about. That's not a technical term. That's just kind of what it sounds like a grittiness.
Right.
Listen to a long reverb tail as it gets really soft. Like if you have a really, really long reverb tail from a good reverb, and as it dies out, you know, have it be really long, like 10, 15 seconds. Right. As it dies out, turn the volume all the way up, and you'll hear as the signal gets soft, it gets really gritty. And that's because in a 24-bit recording, you start to run out of resolution. You might only be using the lowest two or three bits, in which case things are going to sound really gritty. Floating point, you don't have that. The scale sort of expands and contracts to accommodate whatever it needs to. So you're going to get you're still going to get full resolution even on a really soft signal. And it's a really striking difference. It's sort of like it was when we went from 16 to 24-bit. And it was a difference that was so severe you could even hear it at a NAMM show.
Right.
And that's saying something. That's saying something. At 32-bit, if you're recording loud rock and roll, you're not going to hear the difference. I'm sure there are some people who would argue with me on that, but I don't think you can hear the difference practically. But if you're doing dynamic orchestral recordings or recording something like Foley where you're going to have a billion tracks layered, absolutely there's a big difference with 32-bit.
Well, I do know that a lot of classical guys use Nuendo for the recording because of the headroom, because you've had just a tremendous amount of headroom for a long time, and I would imagine that's right. I mean, that's the reason why they would do that.
Yeah, and they're also really fond of the crossfades as well.
Yep.
Those classical guys live and die by their crossfade editor. So.
And keep in mind also, 32-bit recording is different than, say, 32-bit mixing. You know, when you're doing 32-bit recording, you're actually capturing the audio better.
Right.
When you're doing different kinds of mixing, you're affecting how it's processed. But if you record something in 24-bit, you've already lost the magic that 32 would have given you.
Yeah. Well, and that's really good, because I was actually talking to somebody who was a little confused about headroom and actually asked me that question about headroom, if it even mattered anymore. And yes, it does matter. And where it matters is kind of in, you know, counterintuitive what you would think. It's not how loud it is. It's what happens on the lower end.
Well, unless you're talking about clipping, which anybody can turn their stuff down so it's not clipping. If you're not talking about clipping, the main reason headroom is important is for interchange. You know, you can't deliver a mix for television at the wrong level. Right. They'll just reject it.
Right.
In music, I mean, it's sort of the race to make everything louder than everything else.
Right.
And headroom, basically, a delivered CD master these days has no headroom.
Yeah. Well, even TV mixing, it's like we have such a limited amount of headroom. Although that's changed a little bit now that digital television is on the air. When it used to be all analog, you know, you did not want to hit the compressor that's happening over at the transmitter, you know, whatever broadcast station that you were, you know, was going to air your stuff. But nowadays things are changing, especially with things like the Call Mac that's coming around, and just digital. You know, it's amazing. It's kind of like we started over. You know, when they switched to digital TV, it's all these rules. You know, there's still, you know, minus 10, that whole thing. But really, you know, it's kind of open. You'll still hear cable TV, especially cable TV, where some commercials you can barely hear them. Other commercials are just blasting you out, you know. So it's interesting to see all the developments that are happening. But once again, getting back to, you know, the headroom, it's still important, even if we compress the bejeebies on everything.
Yeah, and you know what? It's not really a sexy topic,
right,
as we've proven, but but it's really important to understand how it works. Like when we started doing film and TV mixes at my place, I really studied what they expected us to have and use as far as headroom.
Right.
And all you have to do is turn in one mix that's a few dB too quiet, and you'll never get another opportunity. You know, you got to make sure that your stuff competes. And it's one thing to just get a digital studio and say, it's fine, I'll just use the volume knob to make it the volume I need it. I want to hear it. But as soon as you're delivering your product to someone else, you really have to be calibrated. And it's a really easy thing. It's not hard to calibrate converters and set your room up right.
Right.
And it's funny, the meter that most people use is a little cheapy that Radio Shack sells. Like if you're trying to calibrate your meters to your room with Pink Noise and just set a level.
Right.
You know, everybody uses the little Radio Shack noise meter. Works great.
What's amazing too is the fact that if you don't have an understanding of headroom, it can really affect the sound of your mixes, especially if you're doing any type of independent film where you have a lot of explosions and you have a lot of really super loud moments, and then the rest of your mix is down, a lot lower, and just the quality of the audio where most of your stuff is going to live, great. Every 10 minutes you're going to have these amazing sounding explosions,
right?
But what's going to happen when you have the dialogue? What's going to happen with the whisper? What's going to happen on those really quiet moments?
You can think of the headroom as sort of dictating how your volume knob on your console relates to how loud things are in the room. If you have your headroom calibrated properly, you start to know what things are supposed to sound like. And some consoles, like the D-Control, once you calibrate it, you can actually have a little digital readout of that tells you how loud a certain setting would be in the room. I'm not really explaining that well, but there's an easy way to be able to tell a minus 20 signal will be 85 dB in the room, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'd actually say that headroom is easier to deal with in the digital world, because one thing that's definitely true that no one can argue with is your D to A converters, nothing in digital can go louder than zero. So all you're doing in headroom is determining how far below zero you're going to play for most of your main sound. In the analog world, that wasn't really the case, because you could overload a console, you could push gear way beyond what it was supposed to do.
Right.
And to me, there was always a proper headroom for having everything calibrated and operating right. But the first thing we would always try to do is distort something. And it wouldn't matter. It could be a $1 million console. If it sounds good at 5, let's turn it up to 10 and just see what happens. At that point, things might be clipping. They might be ugly and horrible, but it might be great. In digital, that's not the case. In digital, once you're smacking up against zero, it's usually pretty unpleasant sounding.
But see, the thing that's good about digital is that the boards you would always have to sort of push really – the analog boards, you would always have to push really far to get – to test that. But there's a lot of plugins now, like the analog channel from McDSP and the virtual console that Mike has talked about a couple times from Slate, where you can get potentially some of that sound at sort of whatever level you want.
Right, because it simulates it.
Right, so you can have it either activate or not at sort of whatever input level you put, like on – the virtual console,
right.
There's actually just a knob, I think, which says drive, which sort of is
yep.
most of those emulation things. And
yep.
so it doesn't matter how loud it's hitting that channel. You can turn it, all the way up and have it sound like an SSL yep. going
and
crazy.
The best plugins are ones that can actually properly emulate a clipping input stage.
Yeah.
Like the Waves and Eves stuff is really good for that too.
Yeah.
And that's a trick. It's not just about emulating the loud distortion horribleness. There are subtleties to it.
And the API, actually, too. We had we were big API people at my school, and then I came here and started helping out Mike, and he's a big API person. And I've heard the API stuff, the plugins, and they're actually pretty good as well. They do
very good.
Some cool stuff.
No, they're really good. And it's the controlling that – it's basically controlling the chaos. It's the controlling the chaos of what happens with analog, with digital.
But you use a very important word there, controlling.
Yeah.
And part of the reason to understand headroom is so that you are controlling it, not just bumping up against problems.
Yeah.
If your room is set up right – my rooms are set up right, but we intentionally distort stuff all the time. But we don't have stuff distort unintentionally
right.
because all of the headroom is set up properly. It's just giving you room to play. And the way I mix, Andrew always makes fun of my mixing.
Smiley face.
A yardstick mix with a smiley face EQ. And I like everything louder than everything else. And for the first few years, I'm not sure I knew that faders could be pulled down. I would just make everything louder. But the truth is, even for the way I mix, if the headroom is set up right, I'm not banging against the zero mark.
Yeah.
Well, just also, can we maybe clarify something really fast, actually, for me also?
Uh-huh.
When you're working with either TV specs or just something that needs to be sort of limited to a spec,
right?
The headroom only extends to whatever that spec is, right? Like, so you have all the way up to zero, theoretically, but if you're working at something like a TV show that needs to be at minus six, that's the end of your headroom, right?
Right. What they would usually do is they would say, like, zero's at minus 20, meaning minus 20 is where most of your dialogue should land. And they'll say you can have 14 dB of headroom. And okay. that means nothing can go above minus six.
Okay.
on the full scale digital stage or full scale digital scale. And that means you have to have a brick wall limiter to make sure that nothing sneaks through because they'll reject it if it does.
And that's minus six. I mean, we brick wall at minus 10.
Most of the TV stuff has been minus 10 if it's stereo. But for 5.1 stuff, they often give us up to minus 4, or sometimes they even say go all the way to 0.
No, I'm with you. And when I do DVD stuff, I'll go a little louder than that. I'll go up to minus 6 myself. I'll never go above minus 6. But DVD stuff, anything not for air, I'll raise it a little bit. But for TV stuff, you can never go wrong with minus 10. Actually, a lot of places you can't go above minus 10.
But think about it. That's just where your peaks are. That's not – you don't mix based on where the peaks are. You mix based on where the dialogue is and where the main program is. Right. And that should be at whatever they tell you to use for zero, which usually is minus 20.
Right.
So do you deliver two separate for 5.1 and stereo for TV, or do they take your 5.1, which is at their spec, and then –
No. You deliver separate.
Okay. Yeah. You have a stereo, and then you have a 5.1 mix most of the time. Or – you know, it depends on where you're delivering it to. For the longest time when you go to movie theaters and you see the 20-minute show that they have before then, when we first started doing that, we were delivering 5.1 and stereo, and they were playing the stereo but sending to 5.1, and it was just it wasn't the 5.1 mix. And more than once, I heard something where I knew what the mix was going to sound like, and I'm like, what are they doing? And sometimes they'll take the 5.1 and they'll comp it to stereo, which is even more ridiculous. Yeah. They won't even use the stereo. It's like, really? You
know? It's horrifying what they do to this stuff.
It really is. You know, you got to – basically when it leaves your bay, you just say, okay, it's gone, and it'll never sound as good as it just sounded right then.
That's right.
it's all – you know what it comes down to though, Rob, as we're talking about this? It's just one of those little things that you have to do if you want to put out the best product that you possibly can. And calibrating and know what your headroom is and knowing about headroom is just one of those little things that you got to know.
Compared to the rest of the stuff you have to know, it's not even that tricky.
Right.
I know there are plenty of places on the web that talk about it. And oftentimes your clients will tell you how they want something delivered. I mean, it's a little trickier with music because everybody's just trying to always be louder than everybody else. But even still, you know, I'll if somebody gives me a CD that they want me to match if we're mastering their music, you know, we'll put it up on the meters and see approximately where that headroom is and try to match it. Just keep in mind, the less headroom you have, the more squished things are going to sound. And, you know... theatrical films are an example of something that's not really squished and it sounds great. And a lot of television is squished heavily and you can tell. And a lot of music is squished to the point where it gets destroyed.
But, you know, what's amazing, even with theatrical mixing, with big mixing, you know, they're still using dynamics all over the place. They're still compressing and
limiting. They have a lot of headroom though.
Right. At least. And they're hitting it a little bit different, but yeah, there's...
Well, because you don't play in all your headroom. It's nice to know that you can have an explosion that can peak all the way up close to zero.
Right.
But the truth is you still have to process that explosion so that the meat of it is playing to you above, you know, minus 20 or wherever the zero is for the project. So you still have to be very clever with the processing. It's just, you can tell the difference between something that's limited and not. It just takes a little... bit of the life out of it.
Right. Well, it's your transients. I mean, that's where you're going to get your...
the attacks all go away.
Your those big... if there's anything that's going to spike your little meter out there, it's going to be a sharp attack, a sharp transient, whether it's a plosive syllable from your singer or it's an attack or on the drum or something.
But you know what? It could be in a rainstorm. It could be each individual raindrop. You know, a transient doesn't just have to be a kick drum.
Right.
It's anything that has any kind of defined... attack at all. And so it's amazing how quickly things dull down when you start shaving those off.
And that's my point was going to be is if you know how to calibrate, you know how to work your room and set your headroom and everything, you'll be able to maintain control so you don't lose those things. You don't lose the attack. You don't lose the transients. That's the quickest way to muddy up or to dull your mix is to get rid of the attacks, you know. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you listen to some of the really good compressors, multi-band compressors, you know, like the Slate, the FGX, and the, you know, the L3 or any of the McDSP, any of those. What you really – what separates them a lot of times is how they're dealing with the attacks. That's basically what you're listening for, is how they handle the attacks. Can you still hear that little click on that hi-hat, or does it just kind of thud out, you know? And that's what's so good about the Slate one, is the Slate – the transients are all still there. It sounds really good, you know, and that's what was so bad about, like, the old L1, you know. Uh-huh. It's just – would suck the life out of your mix, you know? So anyway, just a little discussion on headroom and levels and
things. I think we've mangled the concept nicely.
Yeah, and just one last thing to mangle it up. Just because it's film doesn't mean there's actually going to be headroom. There's still some people which either don't know what they're doing or they're directors that want it to be that loud. But I saw a movie recently that there was a couple of animal screams, basically, we'll call them, that were you got the attack, and then the whole scream was the exact same level, and then it just sort of stopped at some point. And it was all at probably like 103 dB in the room, and I was going,
you know what that's called? Terrible, terrible mixing.
Yeah, so just because it's a film doesn't mean it's actually going to sound good.
Or it's also called 4 a.m. Anyway, well, I hope we shed a little bit of light, or shed a little bit of something on
confusion.
It's really interesting. Hey, Greg, I want to ask you one quick question before we wrap things up here. Who are you selling to? It just seems like, you know, I can't imagine that there's all these people that are just buying new DAW software, you know, every day. But obviously there are, because you guys are doing good. But yeah, it just blows me away.
It seems like everyone still wants to be a rock star. So I think, you know, there's a lot of people, obviously, that, you know, go to a buddy's place and maybe they pay them some money and they don't have such a great experience. I'm sure everyone's first studio experience that they paid for wasn't so good. So now it's, you know, very easy to kind of get into it. So, you know, you don't have to have $20,000 to get started. You can get a basic audio interface with software and get started and kind of, you know, learn your own trade. You know?
Does it ever amaze you that you're still selling this stuff? I mean, it just seems like if I was in your shoes, I'd be thinking, who out there who's interested in music doesn't have something already?
Yeah, but, you know, it's, you know, if when you go to, I lecture at a lot of colleges, and just, you know, the whole music business program, music industry program, is there's no shortage of students wanting to get into it. So
yeah, I was going to say, he's about to sell to me after using the ADR stuff. I'm about to.
You know what? That's true too, though. I mean, you know, once you get started, it's kind of like you kind of get bored with what you may be using. And I mean, sometimes I do. I'll be honest. Sometimes I'll just pick up some software because I've been doing something with this software for such a long time, and let me try something else. And it's always kind of cool to try a different software and just get, you know, vibed a different way, and all of a sudden you become creative again, and okay, great, and you know, you stick with that. But interesting.
Actually, I got to give you one last plug too. I forgot about this whenever we were discussing earlier. Y'all have something which I really wish other people have, is sort of on like your mix window where you have the actual like on screen faders. You'll have the option to do the vertical waveform scrolling.
The waveform scrolls.
Yeah, whatever it's actually called. And I really wish that some other DAWs would have gotten on that, because I saw that for the first time on a board on a mixing stage as a feature, and I went, holy crap, that makes perfect sense. And so then when I was going through after that one session that I've mentioned a couple times now, and I was like, oh, these guys are amazing.
Wait, what is it?
So it's actually like metering of the waveform. Now, what's really great about it is, you know, you see the meters reflect what's happening right now, but you could actually see elements coming up, because you see like 3 seconds before and 3 seconds after. So as a project is playing, you can see an explosion coming in the waveform of the meter. So this way, it's very easy to see when parts are coming in, when they're going out.
So the meter is emulating the waveform.
It's a vertical, waveform.
It's like effectively on the mix window or mix the faders are.
Right.
Above that, you can see just the waveform. There's no regions or anything. You don't need any of that. Just literally what is coming up. So if you're in the process of mixing, especially if you have faders in front of you, you can just glance over at the screen and know this track has this coming up without having to figure out where you are vertically on an edit window, which is insane.
That's like a quick look cue sheet kind of.
Yeah, there's – I forget which of the big film consoles.
I think it's a Harrison.
Is it Harrison?
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it's a very cool feature because you don't need a cue sheet. You can actually see a waveform coming up because if you, as soon as you have a lot of faders, it's really hard to look at a cue sheet or look at a screen.
Yeah.
And have it immediately relate your eye to where the sound's going to be coming. But if you actually see an upcoming waveform on a fader, it's really cool.
Man.
It doesn't suck.
Yeah, right? How cool is that?
That is crazy. Well, back in the old days when we had cue sheets. Okay, just so you know what a cue sheet is, it literally was a sheet. And on the sheet, you would have time code. And then on the time code, you would have little marks as to what was coming up on what track. And so the mixer would be here. He'd have cue sheets in front of him and he'd be rolling a picture. So you'd have to look at the picture, look at the cue sheet and make sure you're making the fader movements. I mean, that was like,
so it's not just a clever name.
No.
Well, it's funny because in the old days,
I know.
The thing with DAWs, they would compete for who could print the prettiest cue sheets.
I know. Like,
talk about a contest that no one cares about anymore.
Well, there was literally software for Pro Tools where you would feed your session in and it would print the cue sheet off your session, which basically, if you think about it, was just screenshots of what the waveforms were anyhow, but with the name of the region in the cue sheet.
Well, the thing is, though, there's a whole legacy history to how cue sheets evolved. And, you know, they used to be written out by hand and then they became automated. But a lot of the older school mixers expected a cue sheet to look a certain way or they would, you know,
reject it.
Those days are so gone.
Sonny, where's my cue sheet?
Now we call them markers.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? I could never – I didn't have to mix with cue sheets, but I don't think I could mix with cue sheets because I'd be like flipping pages and trying
to – Well, they'd have them all laid out. It was – I always thought it was confusing. I mean, being able to see the waveform coming is just so elegant.
And that was before you were using Pro Tools as playback because a lot of times back then you were playing back off of like a bunch of slave D88s or
– little Sony 48 tracks for the big stuff.
Yeah, it was – which was, you know, it's amazing. Back in the day where we take like six.
Yeah, it's like 10 years ago. It's not like it's a million years ago.
But we would take like six D88s, slave them all together, and then put the, you know, have them all sync. Why not just bring Pro Tools? I mean,
it's like. Had it existed, yeah.
But this is when it did exist because we made the D88s from the Pro Tools session. It was.
Yeah,
it
wasn't reliable enough to run Pro Tools on a mixing stage.
Oh, man. The things we did back then.
Yeah.
That was back in the whole mag tape days where you would basically take your mix of all these D88s, you'd mix them to the board, and then you'd mix them down to a ton of like 12 like mag machines, which are basically like film machines, but instead of film, they have magnetic tape where you record on them. And you'd basically stem it back out to like 12 of these machines so that you have your stem of
gigantic machines.
Yeah.
And you had to punch in on like transients only. You can't punch in the middle of anything long and sustained.
That's right.
Yeah. No, it was – that's crazy.
Yeah.
How did things get done back then?
I don't know. How did things get done and how come they were done so much better? That's my question.
That's true too.
But admit it, you were happy.
We were all getting paid, I'll say that.
Well, that's when you had like the recordist. You know, you had the mixer and then the recordist. And the recordist actually had to like do a lot of work back there and, you know, make sure all the mag tapes were all, you know, all the machines. I mean, that's when a machine room was like a machine room, right. You know.
There's people in it.
And machines.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's hilarious to go to a facility that used to have a bunch of mag dubbers in the back.
Right.
And they're now in Pro Tools because you go in and it's usually this giant room with a raised floor and all this air conditioning and like one rack with a Pro Tools rig and, you know, 500 square feet of empty space.
Yeah, and that one Pro Tools rig represents what would be like a block of magnets.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, but it's also all the cold storage for whenever they fill up the fridge, they just go stick it in the machine rooms because it's like 20 degrees in there.
Oh, man. Anyhow, well, hey, Greg, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
On this podcast. You must have pissed off the rest of the guys.
I got the farthest traveled war.
That's true. That is true.
Oh, you know what? Dang, I wanted to talk about that too. We'll have to bring you back and talk about it. We got to do a podcast about traveling with your gear.
Oh yeah,
because there's some.
We all have some good stories.
Great about that. Stories on that. You know what? That's note to self. All right. Well, anybody want to talk about anything that they're working on that's interesting?
I will say I just finished up the first orchestral project I've done in a while and recorded the orchestra at my place, and it turned out really cool, and it's going to be for a trailer in theaters. Actually, by the next podcast, it should be out. But it was one of those projects where I did a combination of live players and the synth orchestra as well, and it really turned out great. It's amazing how much better the combination is than just synths. I mean, even if you have the best sample libraries on earth, there's just once you get a little bit of rosin on the string samples, it's just amazing how it brings the whole thing to life.
And how many players did you have?
We had 15 players, but a lot of them played double and triple parts. So we ended up simulating about an 80 piece.
Wow.
And it's
which stage?
Awesome.
Hmm? Which stage was it on?
The Rob Zone stage. It was done at my place.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know, when budgets allow, I love to go do it at Sony or Fox, but budget wasn't allowing. So we did it at my place, and I have a big open room where we can get a lot of sort of distant slap in it.
Nice.
Really worked great. I mean, it's always a tricky mix. You got to kind of match the simulated ambience you're putting on the stuff recorded in a small room with the library samples, which usually have massive ambience on
right.
them. So you got to kind of bring it all together so it congeals into one space. But the end result, you would never know. It's not in a big concert hall. It's just perfect.
And it probably took Gary, like, what, 13 seconds to match
he's
that?
A pretty quick mixer. And the key is having a great mixer, obviously.
Yeah, he's probably like, okay, yeah, that's a pre-delay of like 0.57. And then we put a little tail in it. Okay, here we go.
Yeah, I mean, when the clients from the ad agency, I didn't let them come over while we were recording because I said, you know, that's definitely watching how sausage is made. But, you know, you need to try to picture it as, you know, me in a tuxedo conducting in a big concert hall because that's what it's going to sound like. But when they heard the end result, they lost their mind.
Wow.
Especially with what they were spending, you know. Most bang for the buck.
That's great. That's awesome.
So that'll be in theaters in a few weeks, and I'll let you know when. And actually, definitely. I think it'll be in all kinds of different media. It'll be a pretty high-profile thing. And I'm working on some video game stuff with Mr. Gershon, who's not here tonight, but that's been really fun.
Yeah, Scott, he's at a premiere.
Yes.
Bobby's at he's hanging out with his rock star buddies.
Right.
And
at a birthday party.
That's right. Andrew's in England.
Yep.
Boy, I feel really inadequate right now. Greg, anything, one last opportunity to plug all things Steinberg?
Yeah, I think we have our developers that are working very hard in some new stuff, and we see a new VST instrument pad shop, like a granular synth that Ooh. Was just announced. It looks really interesting.
So are you saying that there could be, just things happening?
There's a lot of guys staying up late.
And what is the current latest version of Cubase Nuendo? Is it, it's Cubase 6,
yeah, five,
right?
Yeah, 6.05 for Cubase and 5.52 for Nuendo.
Got it.
Nice. How about your own music? Do you play? Do you get a chance to play? I mean, I know you travel all over the place.
I kind of travel constantly. I do play in a band where I don't do any technology stuff whatsoever. I just show up as the bass player.
Awesome.
So one bass, one little combo amp, and it's great. Yeah.
That's awesome. No latency issues with that?
Yeah, no word clock to worry about. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, actually, speaking of staying up late nights, coming up pretty soon actually might be before this post, so maybe it's past tense, but I've been doing some paid work lately, which is really good, but I very stupidly signed up for a project coming up, which I will be guaranteed not sleeping. And when you start a project, you sort of hope you're going to be able to sleep, but you know in the back of your mind you won't be able to sleep. I know I'm not going to be sleeping for this one, and it's a seven-day project. Basically, they give you a prompt, and then you write, shoot, edit, and do some quick sound and color for a project. And so basically I'm going to get it like 24 hours before it's done. It's supposed to be about 10 minutes long. And they're going to go, well, see what happens. So that's either coming up or behind me. And I don't know why, but I like it. So.
Okay, really quick. Jeremy is a madman. I just want to tell you that right off the bat, okay? And I know for all of you that were waiting for a podcast 115 and there was a little bit of a break, let me tell you Jeremy's work schedule that he's had. The last 29 days, he's had 2 days off, maybe?
Yeah, that's...
He worked 14 days straight. He worked on Super Bowl Sunday.
Nice.
He worked until like 11 at night all those days. It was... ridiculous. I text him, Jeremy, can you help me with this? No, I'm working. Okay. Jeremy, do we have this? No, I'm working.
Okay, in fairness, I may have been sleep deprived, so hopefully I wasn't actually that rude.
You know what? Jeremy's like you, Rob. Jeremy is not a phone person at all.
That's cool. Like, phone is a waste of time. I hate the phone.
Rob is not a phone person.
I hate the phone.
Don't try calling Rob because
you
will get angry Rob.
He always takes my calls.
I do take Greg's calls.
Well,
Greg's usually calling me back to answer a question that I've called him desperately with, so of course I'm going to take his calls.
Well, you know what, you will take my calls. You may be a little salty, but you will take them.
I just don't do the small talk. It's like, tell me why you're calling. Tell me what we need to accomplish. Let's accomplish it so I can get back to work.
Yeah, actually, we realized that I'm very similar to you, Rob, because I think it was like maybe a month ago already. Mike called me, and I just said, what? But
that's worse than me. I don't do that.
No. But then in response, he was like, wait, Rob? So he actually thought he had called the wrong number.
It was, I don't know, man. You've got a little,
A little protege. And rudeness. Well, hopefully you pick up some of the good traits, too, if there are any.
Hopefully, yeah. But see, you're a little saved because, you say noisy neighbors whenever people call, especially for, the business stuff. It was my cell phone, so there was no, like, oh, I might need to be nice.
Yes. Yeah, right. No, that's right.
So sorry about that, Mike.
See, you know what? And I'm the total opposite. Call me. You want to talk to me? Call me. Don't send me a text. I don't have to look at anything. I don't have to read anything. I just tell me. Tell me what you want.
That's because you have a long commute.
I'm really nice.
Exactly.
Well, that's true too.
You are really nice. And what are you working on?
I'm producing some content right now. Some original content that will be coming out probably in about 2 months.
Like visual, audio?
Audio content. It's all about – I've decided to take my own advice and – do content. So
nice.
I'll definitely tell you more when we get closer, but the way technology is, there's really no reason why you can't just start a project and just do a project on your own. And it's not a record or anything like that, but I'll let people know more when we get closer to releasing it. But
cool.
It's kind of fun. It's kind of exciting and calling in all kinds of favors.
Oh yeah. I know what that's like.
Well, hey, listen, this was kind of fun. It was small but intimate. Thank you, Greg, once again for joining us. And look forward to seeing what Steinberg does next. It's great that Steinberg and Yamaha are getting along really well.
Yeah, it's been a great marriage.
And that new hardware stuff, I got some of those little controllers, and they're really cool.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a must-buy, because especially they're not that expensive at all. And little controllers like that, especially when you travel, it's going to be amazing. Can't wait. If you have any questions or comments for any of the guys or the guy on the panel, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Bobby Osinski, I think he's working on a TV program right now. That's why he's not here.
Ooh.
One that he's directing. So
nice.
I really feel inadequate.
And what's our Facebook page?
You can reach us on our Facebook at facebook.com/audionowcast. And that's about it. So anything else? Any closing words?
Happy Valentine's Day.
Which was 2 weeks ago.
But it's still important because we love all of you.
That's true.
Jeremy, that was so nice. All right, well, hey, for myself and the rest of the guys, wherever they may be, we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and West Wave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.